Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds
Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today's Thursday, June 5th, 2014. And here are some of the things we'll look at today. We've got some more fun stuff about the NSA, because that's like the story that never keeps giving, or never stops giving, I should say. They keep taking, right? We're also going to talk a little bit about Obamacare, but we're starting off with an interesting little story that came out about Steve Forbes. And it might actually create a little bit of a controversy here in our conversation between Bill and I. But we're also going to have fun with it later on because, as you might have heard in our promo for this week, we're going to do a special segment where I travel over basically to another dimension where there's a libertarian society. This is based on a novel from 1979 called The Probability Brooch. So we're going to have a little fun to use that as a way to compare the USA with what it could be if we had a more libertarian society. But, Bill, right now we're living in the USA, and right now we're living without a gold-based dollar. So because of that, Forbes' piece is a little bit controversial.
Well, we can't overlook the biggest news story of the whole week.
Now, which one's that?
June 1st.
You have to give a little more clue than that.
It was my birthday. I turned 30
before that. Unfortunately, USA Today didn't pick that one up.
We don't have a news article on that? Oh, no.
Well, we didn't get the PR out in time. That was the problem. But happy birthday, Bill.
Thank you.
Yeah, I won't even say how old you are. We'll let you do that yourself, okay?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, Steve Forbes is publishing a book, and, of course, Forbes' name may not be familiar to a lot of our listeners, but he was a primary economist in the Reagan administration and, of course, is fairly prominent in the liberty movement and is something of a libertarian. But the book is primarily about economics and monetary policy, and he's saying that unless we switch back to a gold-based currency, the whole economic system is going to collapse. It's going to be a disaster.
And actually, that's not quite what he said. What he said is that the dollar has to be tied to gold.
Yeah.
He didn't really,
gold-backed currency,
which basically means he doesn't mind expanding the money supply and basically violating the whole principle of a gold standard. He just wants to make sure that there's a tie.
Well, but the theory of the gold standard is that the amount of gold is limited and it's not open to, you know, sole discretion of governments as to how much gold there is or what it's worth.
But the problem, of course, is that the reason the gold standard failed isn't because of the gold. It's because the government doesn't actually protect the standard. They've already not protected it. That's why, you know, the gold standard fell apart in the first place, because from the moment the Fed was created in 1913, over the next 15, 20 years, they basically ignored the whole idea of the gold standard and just went crazy with monetary creation. And then when the spam hit the fan, they said, well, it's all the gold standard's fault.
Yeah, right. Well,
you know,
we can't go into detail on the history, of course, but one of the reasons why we ended up with a fiat currency, which is no gold, no silver, it doesn't matter, was that they originally set up the standard as a bimetal standard. And they said, okay, here's a gold dollar bill, and here's a silver dollar bill. Well, what they didn't take into account was the fact that the amount of silver and the amount of gold is variable, and the relationship
To clarify, the early silver wasn't actually a paper dollar bill. It was actually a coin. Silver certificates came much, much later.
Right.
But your point is
right. Right. So what they had to do was they had to deplete the content of, I think it was silver, in the silver dollar coins in order to match it up with the gold dollar coins. And so they discovered that, well, they changed this to match up with market demand. But then they said, well, what the heck? We can do it, you know, to match market demand. Why can't we just reduce the amount of silver and the amount of gold in all the coinage, and we'll have more money?
Well, they also did a little bit more than that. I mean, this is kind of tying into what the whole free silver movement was around the turn of the 20th century.
Right.
But they essentially knocked silver out as part of the currency in, what was it, 1873 or something like that? I can't remember what the exact year was. So, yeah, they did a little bit more than just they'll tweak it a little bit.
Yeah, and you know, the initial paper currency was not fiat currency. It was an actual note. You could take a dollar bill and turn it in for an ounce of gold or whatever it was. And so it was the silver certificates were the most common bills circulated as U.S. dollars. So they were reserve notes. They weren't currency in and of themselves until the politicians realized that they could print up, you know, all kinds of paper anytime they wanted to, and people would accept it as though it were the same as a silver-backed or gold-backed coin, a note. So that
right,
was...
Yeah.
So anyway,
again, we're kind of playing a little bit fast and loose with history because the part you're talking about here happened in the 20th century. But yes.
Well, I mean, it wasn't until Nixon that we abandoned the gold standard altogether.
Well, we pretty much abandoned it under FDR. The only thing that was left of the gold standard after FDR was that countries would exchange currency based on gold, but individuals, it was done.
Well, but Nixon actually banned for a short period of time the possession of gold by Americans.
Well, so did FDR.
Well, okay. So, but not, it wasn't exactly the same.
It was a race to the bottom here.
Well, yeah. I'll agree with that. Anyway, the point of Forbes' book is that as a consequence of misguided monetary policies, we're setting the stage for a total economic and social catastrophe, one that he says could rival the crisis and horrors of the 1930s. So he's making the case that we need to go back to a gold-linked currency as an alternative to the Fed just printing up money whenever it pleases.
The problem with that analysis, and I appreciate that he's bringing gold into it, that in itself deserves some kudos. But the problem with the analysis is that it fails to take into account why the Fed was created in the first place. And it wasn't created in the first place because gold doesn't make good currency. It was created in the first place because gold and the dollar were simply loosely tied together under a so-called gold standard that nobody actually honored. So the question in my mind is, well, why go back to a gold standard that nobody's going to honor anyway? It doesn't really solve anything. It's one of those things that Forbes likes to put out that makes him sound like he believes in sound money, but he really doesn't. I mean, he likes the idea of the manipulable money supply. He just doesn't like the crashes that comes afterwards. So that's why he wants to retain the Fed. He doesn't want to get rid of the Fed.
Well, I haven't read the book, so I don't know what his basic argument is. I thought it was an interesting perspective. My perspective on the Fed was a little bit different. The reason why the Fed was organized was basically as an insurance company for banks, so that they would put money into a reserve so that when there was a run on the banks could actually redeem and pay out deposits.
Right, but let's go back to why there are runs on the banks in the first place.
Well, because the banks were lying.
Well, more than that, they were engaging in fractional reserve currency.
Yeah, but that's
fractional
what,
reserve
that's what,
currency is exactly what you get when you play fast and loose for the gold standard.
Fractional reserve currency is saying, okay, I'll accept your deposit for a dollar. I'll pay you back a dollar whenever you want to, unless I have it invested in something else that's making me money.
Yeah, it's the wimpy version of money supply. I'll pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. That's basically what it amounts to. And it's essentially making two promises at once, knowing perfectly well that if both promises actually come back to call and say, yeah, I want to close this deal, you can't do it because you can only have the money in one hand at a time, not in two hands.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, the government for a long time recognized that this is a very profitable way for banks to operate because, you know, if they're lending out money that doesn't belong to them, they can make a ton of money doing that. That's very
right.
profitable. And the government right. certainly didn't want to shut that down because, of course, the government likes to be funded by the banking system. So that's why they're
right.
back.
Yeah.
But let's not pretend for even a second that this had anything to do with anything other than debasing a gold standard. That's essentially what it was.
Well, it was that's what it became.
It's been that way since the country was founded. It goes back to the colonies. It goes back to the beginning of the Bank of England, for goodness sake. This is the way banking has been done throughout the ages, and it's been done this way primarily because the government, whether it be a king or a democracy or whatever, found it to be very useful. But in every instance, they were always debasing currency in order to make it happen.
Yeah, Yeah, no, there's no doubt about that. I'm just saying that historically the justification for the Fed initially was to insure against bank runs.
Right, because they didn't want to give up on what was causing it.
Right, right. They didn't want to deal with the cause, so they dealt with the effect.
Yeah, so essentially you pretend that debasing the currency and that creating a loose gold standard is healthy so that you can get away with making tons of money that didn't belong to you in the first place, and then you come back with a solution that doesn't really address the problem but simply covers it up so you can continue to go on with basically taking money that doesn't belong to you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I haven't read Forbes' book, but
actually summarized in the article that you found too. It actually says right in there that he's basically doing it to keep the Fed in line, which means he doesn't want to get rid of the Fed. So he's perfectly happy with it. He just doesn't like the fact that they're creating money out of thin air, which is kind of contradictory when you think about it.
Then they get back to the original purpose, which was as an insurance company for banks. Providing a common reserve so that when there was a bank run that it wouldn't collapse other banks.
But even that was based on a fractional reserve currency.
Yeah.
And continuously is that. You can't have that kind of a system without a fractional based currency. In fact, you don't even need it unless you have a fractional based currency.
Well, but it's interesting. We had as a guest several months back, G. Edward Griffin. Mm-hmm. And he's written the authoritative history of the Fed, and one occasion he was talking about all the things we've been discussing here, but he was talking about fractional reserves, and I said to him during his little speech or after his little speech, is there anything inherently wrong with honest fractional reserves?
Yeah,
in other words,
that conversation.
Yeah, if a person makes a deposit and they're not being fooled into thinking that their money is just in storage, available whenever they want it, but the bank is actually going to invest that money, then they are honestly told what the bank's history is and what they're investing in and what the risks are and so on and so forth, is that a bad thing? And he said no.
And I have to admit, as much as I like Ed Griffin on that point, I think he's wrong. There is something inherently wrong with it. Essentially, it's legalized theft. It's even though you know that you're being stolen from, it's still theft.
Well, but if for example, the bank says, okay, if you deposit $1,000, we're going to make investments for you, and if we earn a lot of money, we're going to give you most of it back and keep the rest for ourselves. And you say, yeah, okay, here's $1,000. Now, the risk is you're going to lose $500 or $5,000 or whatever it is, but you aren't going to be liable for the losses in excess of what you deposited. So if that's a contract, then it's not the bank isn't a depository institution. You're not putting money in storage. You're investing it in the bank's wisdom. And doing that honestly, I don't think,
contract.
Is wrong.
Here's the key thing, though. It's a bad contract. It's a bad deal because you basically take on all the risk and they take all the profits. Now, if that were truly an uncoerced contract, that would be one thing. But once the banks are allowed to engage in that on a regular basis, as we've seen historically, then that becomes the rule of thumb. That becomes the only way you can do banking. And when that becomes the only way to do banking, there is no reasonable way that any person can say it is an uncoerced transaction. It is now a coerced transaction because it now becomes the only way to participate.
Well, that's only because of the government being involved. If it was a voluntary contract between you and the bank, then that's a different matter.
It's not just because of the government being involved. It's because when you allow a bank to legally get away with essentially pushing on the population a bad deal that continues to make the bank money, the bank makes more and more of those deals. In essence, they become the controller of the money supply. And through that control, they essentially prevent any other option from coming out. The only way you can actually stop fraud is by making it illegal. You can't stop fraud by making it legal and saying, oh, well, we'll regulate it.
Yeah. No, I agree. I agree.
And this is an example of fraud.
That's what I said. It's based on a lie. And if fraud were being prosecuted and people were aware that the money they're depositing is not in storage.
But even if they're aware of it, even if they're aware that they're getting a bad deal, it's still fraudulent. It's still fraudulent to knowingly push people into making a bad deal because there's no way it remains uncoerced forever. It can't.
Well, that's because you can't have like a co-op bank or a variety of different religious banks that are genuine depositories. Well, who actually deposit money and they don't invest it. They just put it in storage.
Whatever.
No, there are some religions.
I mean, religious banks are so good, the Vatican Bank would be the best bank in the world. I mean.
Well, usury was a common sin among a lot of different world religions, and so charging interest is an aspect of the monetary process. I'm just saying that the reason why banks can get away with it is because banks have a monopoly only if they participate in this fraud.
Well, yeah, and you want to make that a legalized fraud by saying, well, everybody knows about it, so therefore it's okay.
No, everybody knows about it. Therefore, if they want to deal with a bank that is a depository that makes no investments and maybe charge you, a penny a month or whatever to keep that dollar in storage, there's nothing wrong with that. That would be a perfectly legitimate business. And
there's nothing wrong with that if there are other alternatives where you can do better. But that's not the way the thing gets set up. Is it?
What gets set up?
The economic system that we're talking about here, basically the monetary system we're talking about here, although we're kind of skating away from that at this point.
Well, if it were illegal for banks to lie to consumers or misrepresent to consumers what was going to happen to their money, then they would have to disclose the risks that were involved and so on and so forth. And people might very well go to the bank with the lowest risk, which was, practically zero, but a fixed amount of storage of their money. And there was no investment involved. No fractional reserves, no nothing.
And plus there's also the, I don't know what else to call it, I guess it's the passenger effect, which is that if you yourself don't engage in this activity, but your neighbor does, and thereby increases the money supply and thereby debases the money supply, you just lost anyway, even though you didn't participate.
Well, I don't know. I think the fractional reserve system is a static thing. Once the fractional amount has been established, it's fixed, unless you reduce the amount of reserves.
No,
I think
never,
we're down to like...
The monetarists would like you to believe that it's fixed. And they would like you to believe it's fixed because once you maximize the expansion of money to the farthest amount you can do it, then there's at least in theory a limit there. But in practice, we found that there is no limit. I mean, for instance, right now in theory, it's supposed to be, I think, a 10% reserve on deposit with the Fed. But in reality, that reserve is closer to 1% and perhaps even less than that because they build in all these exceptions along the way.
Yeah, well,
you allow yourself to build an exception along the way. It's no longer a limit.
Well, but because they're undisclosed. In other words, if a bank had to post the amount of
it doesn't matter if they're disclosed or not. Most of these financial activities are so far beyond what the ordinary person would understand in the first place. And by the way, that's why the banks have done this for all these years. But because it's so far beyond what most people would understand, you could put it as a headline in the Wall Street Journal that these things are happening, and the average person would say, huh? They wouldn't get it.
They
wouldn't understand what was being done to them.
But it can be simplified. For example, if every bank had to post the amount of their fraction in their fractional reserves, they had to say, for every one of your dollars you deposit, we are loaning out $10, and you are at risk for that $10. Then
the average person
customers could look at that 1 in 10 and say, I want a bank with a 1 in 2 or a 1 in 1 or whatever.
Yeah, so the average person who saw that, their eyes would cross, their minds would boggle, and they'd say, huh? They wouldn't understand that because how can you possibly lend out $10 on a dollar? That's what would go through their mind. And they'd be right, by the way, because you really can't.
Well, not without taking a huge risk. I mean, that's...
So you basically have released to them information that doesn't make any sense to them. Now, if you're lucky, some of them will try to take some action to move away from that, but others won't. And when that happens, when those others don't because they don't know what else to do, guess what? You've just increased the money supply.
Well, yeah, I think if customers are informed, they can understand that their money being deposited is either at risk or not.
They shouldn't even
have
to.
And if so, how much the risk is?
They shouldn't have. There's no need to have a law in place that says the banks can cheat people. Or even to make it legal to cheat people because you reveal to them that you're going to cheat them. There's no need to have that. It's totally unnecessary to a healthy economy.
So you're saying there shouldn't ever be any fractional reserve system whatsoever?
Absolutely.
So you're saying that there's...
Financial reserve, by definition, is theft.
Well, but, you know, for example, that would eliminate any such thing as a 401k or buying options or futures or anything else.
No, it wouldn't.
Because
absolutely
you're...
That is not true at all.
Okay.
It's not true. You have not... Give me one piece of evidence that suggests that that's true, because I don't think
well,
you can.
There are regular investments that a person can make. They deposit their money not into a storage facility, but into an investment facility.
Why do those if you no longer have fractional reserve banking?
But that's still fractional reserve. And when I make a dollar investment in Disney, I give it to a brokerage, and that brokerage buys Disney stock. And fortunately, I have the choice of what my risks are on Disney or something else. But I can also give it to an investment firm that says we change our investments day by day, and the risk varies day by day, and that's the chance you're taking. Hopefully, we'll make a lot of money.
Yeah, but that does not give them the power that a bank has. And bear in mind, this is a very key power that the bank has. It does not give them the power to include it on their balance sheet as if it were their own currency. That's the key factor here. Banks are legally allowed, they're permitted by law, to count anything that goes into their bank as if it was their own. They don't have to separate it out into a separate accounting that is completely separate from their own balance sheet.
Oh, okay. Well, but that's an element of fraud, and I agree that shouldn't exist.
That's the basis of fractional reserve banking. You don't have fractional reserve banking without that.
Well, for example, if I deposit $10,000 in an investment company, I know they're going to buy housing, and I know the housing is a risky investment, and I might get my $1,000 back, or I might get $5,000.
Where is the money coming from that the investment bank is lending to you? Where's it coming from?
The money's coming from me.
Okay, so you're lending the money out, and somebody else is investing it.
Doing the investments, right.
Spending it. They're using it in a business somewhere.
Right.
Okay? Who gets the lion's share of any profits on that?
As part of the contract deal, they take a 5% commission or 10% commission or whatever it might be, depending upon their success rate.
I didn't ask you that. I asked you who gets the lion's share of the profits, if there are any profits to be made.
Well, I would get the lion's share, the 90% or whatever it was.
So essentially they're working on a commission.
Right. And I'm saying the banks could operate on a commission too.
That's dramatically different from what a bank does. Not an investment bank, a regular commercial or savings bank. That's dramatically different from what they do. And we both know it.
I mean, I understand your point in that they are committing the fraud of loaning out money they don't have.
And furthermore, any of those assets that you lend out, they don't appear in a truly free society as assets owned by the investment bank.
Well, but here's another example. I can buy Disney stock, or I can buy it on margin, in which case the investment house loans me the money, and they're for sure going to get all of their money back that they're loaning me on margin plus interest. And if the stock goes up...
Money that the investment bank loans, where do they get it from?
Well, the investment bank is just creating it from the multiple and assuming most of the risk.
From the multiple, meaning fractional reserve banking.
Right.
So, in other words, they're engaging in fraud, too.
No, because theirs is above board. Theirs is above board. Theirs is a contractual relationship. When I'm buying stocks on margin.
Here's the thing. You don't have to engage in lending money to somebody and do it fraudulently. The legal way to do it, the legitimate way to do it, is not to lend somebody else's money and pretend that it's your own. It's to lend your own. Or to be nothing more than a broker for lending out somebody else's money, but not to combine them together.
Well, I understand the point, and I agree that that's fraudulent.
Well, if that's fraudulent, then I think we can also agree that, yes, you can have IRAs without having fractional reserve banking. Yes, you can have various forms of investment without having fractional reserve banking. Your turn now.
I get your point, and I agree with your basic happened. Point.
That was your point. Yes. Well, your point apparently is not true.
Well, I still think that you could have an honest, you know, up above board relationship with a bank.
Why would you? Well, yes, you can have an up board, above board relationship with a bank as long as the bank isn't what we currently understand to be a bank, where the bank basically steals from Peter in order to lend to Paul.
Right.
But let's turn it around to what a legitimate bank would be. A legitimate bank would be a depository, okay?
Right.
I think we agree on that. And
right.
If you want to lend out money, they can act as a broker to lend out the money. But they can't claim it as their own. Okay? That would become a legitimate system. Do we agree?
Yeah.
Okay. So
now without my permission. Yeah.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. So we would agree then that it becomes possible to make loans, to fund an economy, to do all those things that an economy needs to do. So it raises the question, why would you want to alter the arrangement to allow people to engage in the illegitimate practice of fractional reserve banking as long as it's all above board, which it really never is? Why would you want to bother with that when you don't need it?
We're getting too deep into the muck here, but
I
understand your point, and I understand, you know, the fraudulent.
The entire fractional reserve system is defended by people who engage in very, I'm not saying you're doing this, but who engage in very, very sleight of hand type arguments, where they say, well, you need it to do this, you need it to do that, and so forth, but you really don't. When you look at the brass tacks, at the very root of it, you find you really don't need it at all. And that's an important point, because once people really understand you don't need it, well, why keep the darn thing?
Of course, then you transition from fractional reserve banks into what the Fed does, which is they just fabricate reserves out of the blue without any regard to how much deposit there is, or how many assets there are in the various member banks.
Well, actually, we transitioned to a point where we don't need the Fed anymore, because if we're not engaging in any kind of fraudulent banking practices, the Fed need disappears. There's no point.
As a footnote to this, maybe concluding that the insurance component was spun off as a different part of the Fed. It's called the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation.
Right.
Which guarantees used to guarantee deposits up to $10,000, then it went to $100,000. Now I think it's at $200,000 or something like that. So you're guaranteed that you're never going to lose, you know, up to $2,000. The amusing thing, here's the fraction, $0.001 for every dollar being insured.
Yeah, that's. That's a statistic that should make everybody pause and be concerned. By the way, did you note what the ECB bank was doing, the European Central Bank was doing this week? It's kind of amusing. They've now set their base deposit rate at minus 0.1%. Actually, gone into negative territory.
Well, the Fed came close to that. They're what, 0.1% now or something like that in effect for the big banks? If you borrow money, you're paying 0.1% interest?
Basically, the big banks now in Europe that have to keep a reserve at the central bank, they now have to pay for the privilege, which actually seems kind of fair when you think about it. But, I mean, it shows how ludicrous the whole system is. And they're trying to do this. Here's the really weird part. They're trying to do this in order to lubricate the economy. I'll figure that one out.
Mm-hmm. A few weeks back, we were talking about the fact that a lot of those foreign banks were making demands on the U.S. Treasury to return their gold, which I think is an interesting development that's, you know, being totally suppressed in the media and nobody's taking much note of. But after the Cyprus debacle, when the European Central Bank took all of the gold in the Cyprus banks, every bank under the sun said, we better get some gold here because something's got to break real soon, and gold is the only security that we have. And I think that was basically Forbes' point.
Especially funny, too, considering that Bernanke a few years ago told us that gold was an archaic tradition that we just kind of hang on to. Like it doesn't really matter, you know.
Well, anyway,
we used up a half an hour on
this. Yes, we did.
Oh, dear. Let's take a break. After, we'll try to touch on one or two more things, and then we'll have our little trip to the other dimension, which should be kind of fun. Sound good?
Sounds good.
All right. So this is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back.
There we go. Little theme song.
Well, now we're officially back here on the Freedom News Hour. Walt and Bill on this Thursday evening, and you know, it occurred to me that since we're talking about gold, we should probably talk about the NSA because they won't like that topic very much. So what are some of the interesting things? Well, first of all, the NSA, did I see this headline right? They actually have targeted 122 world leaders?
Yeah. The NSA got a top secret court order against Germany was one example, but there were several other companies involved. And they, along with British spy agency, started clandestine operations infiltrating all these different companies' computer service, eavesdropping on communications of their staff. This is something that's disclosed in some Snowden documents that were released on The Intercept, which is a new website where Glenn Greenwald and others are doing it. There are stories on Snowden documents. So anyway, in the course of this eavesdropping, not just on commercial enterprises, but on actual world leaders, they came up with a list of 122 targeted leaders around the world, not in the United States, obviously, that they were actually eavesdropping on in order to find out what kind of commercial activities were being promoted and what kind of operations they were doing among themselves. So it's another, you know, intriguing eavesdropping program for the NSA.
Well, I suppose this all falls into the category of protecting us from terrorism. Is that right?
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah, Angela Merkel is definitely a terrorist. You know, there's reasonable articulable suspicion that Angela Merkel is working with our enemies.
Well, yeah, I mean, the FISA court can't argue with that, can they?
No.
And then, of course, there's the news, which really shouldn't be news, that the NSA is now collecting all of our pictures.
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of like the NSA is the development project for anything to do with massive databases, and one of them is facial recognition. Now, facial recognition software is still very bad. I mean, it's the chances. You watch some of these programs, the intelligence or continuum or something like that. You know, they do a facial recognition and bang, there it is, the exact match to the Joe Blow. Of course, in the actual software implementation, because people's faces are very confusing and video images aren't very, you know, high resolution usually. They come up with like a 20 to 50% false positives and false negatives, and so it's really a throw of the dice. But that hasn't prevented the NSA from glomming on to every picture of every face they can find on the internet, as well as anything they can find, you know, by monitoring private communications, whether it's Skype or anything else that involves picture exchanges. So the British word is hoovering, hoovering up pictures across the internet and putting it into their big databases so that they can run their facial recognition document, their programs against all these various images.
So is there any truth to the rumor that Angela Merkel came up as a positive, a false positive in that because they determined that her image looked like Osama bin Laden?
No, she looked like Oprah Winfrey.
Wait a minute. I think you just called Oprah Winfrey a terrorist. You sure you want to take that one back?
Oh, I'll take it back.
Yeah.
No, it's an interesting technology, and basically they're extracting dimensions from, you know, the face they have on an image, putting it into a computerized system, and trying to match up all these different dimensions against other faces. So, it's something that probably will develop. It'll probably develop with, you know, all kinds of NSA money. But it's a very, very unreliable system of identifying people.
Well, they say that government intelligence is a contradiction in terms, so I guess this is another form of proof that theorem is true.
Yeah.
Another form of proof that the theorem is true is something that came out of the Veterans Administration scandal that's been rocking the news world over the last few weeks. And an interesting side note that came out of that one, I've seen this in a few places, but apparently liberal defenders, particularly in the, you know, the forums and the comment sections of the articles and so forth, are keen to the idea that it's rather embarrassing for the VA to have this huge scandal going on at the same time that they're continuing to try to sell Obamacare to us, because it's an indicator that the government isn't particularly good at running healthcare systems. So there's been a lot of screening by the left saying, well, you know, you can't call the VA a single-payer system, because truly it's not a single-payer system. A single-payer system is where the government pays. The government is the one payer in the whole system. Nobody else there, no insurance companies or anything like that involved, which, of course, misses the point, because the point is this was a matter of government mismanagement. It had nothing to do with who was paying the bill.
Yeah. No, that's true. There is a crossbreed thing that isn't getting a lot of news coverage. Not just the VA, but every medical facility, hospitals and doctors, are obliged by a variety of new regulations to computerize all of their records. Now, one of the big boondoggles in the VA system was that they computerized their system, but nobody could retrieve anything, and nobody could get, you know, patient data when a particular veteran came into a particular hospital. And they couldn't exchange it among other hospitals because they were doing it state by state, and each state did a different VA system, and so they can't talk to each other. So when a veteran moved from one state to the other, the electronic system was totally useless. And this is kind of similar to what's happening with the Obamacare exchanges, where the states are setting up their system to interface with the feds, but they have slightly different regulations and methods of processing and so on and so forth. So this whole, computerization that's supposed to make government more efficient just introduces all kinds of new complications and results in lousy care or managed care or prioritized care.
And there's also the question of whether or not the insurance companies are going to have to get bailed out by all this, because the Obamacare regulations are so preposterous that it's going to get to the point where the insurance companies are going to start screaming, we're not making any money doing this anymore. We're about to lose the money.
Yeah, well, and this was a little noted in the course of the Obamacare debate because nobody wanted to use the word bailout. But in essence, there is a bailout for the insurance companies built into Obamacare so that they don't lose money. And that bailout is becoming a bigger and bigger possibility as the numbers start coming in as to how much insurance companies have to pay to comply with the regulations.
Now, how real a possibility is this? I mean, is this pie in the sky, or is this something that's actually starting to show up on the horizon?
Well, let's see. There's a good likelihood of a shortfall in the 2015 year. That's next year. HHS says that the regulation as it stands requires the IRS to make full payment to insurers for the coverage that they're getting. But in the backhand is that if the insurance companies don't get paid enough to make a particular profit, the feds will bail them out. They'll pay them whatever the difference is. So if it turns out that, in order to cover pre-existing conditions, it's going to cost them the X billions of dollars more than what they anticipated, the feds will just pay them, and the insurance companies will come out with a profit.
So we haven't gotten any firm numbers on what that's going to be,
no.
But there's a hint that it's actually going to turn that direction, and it's coming from HHS.
Yes.
Yeah, that's not a good thing. When the government admits that it's happening before it happens, you know it's a bad thing.
Yeah. And that's one reason why they're hiding all statistics. You still don't know. From among the claimed 8 million people who enrolled in Obamacare, how many of them actually paid their premiums? And how many of them dropped out? How many of them were young? How many were old? How many were pre-existing conditions? How many were not? So there's going to be no way for them to know. But you'll see the first indications come up in October when the insurance companies actually have to decide what their new rates are going to be, how much they have to increase it over previous year. So there will be some indication coming up in the next 3 or 4 months.
Well, that should be fun to watch, and I say that rather sarcastically. Hey, we're at our last third of the program. Let's go to our little special segment that we've set up, because I've been looking forward to this. And frankly, I'll tell everyone, the reason why I wanted to do this at all was because of all the negative news we're constantly talking about. You know, the Obamacare thing, there's another example of it, and what's likely to come in October. Everything we touch on is like negative, 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 negative. We got to get some positive in here. So I said to Bill, why don't we try just doing something where we're talking as if we're from a libertarian society. And what came to my mind was a novel that most people don't know about. It's a very obscure novel, published in 1979. It actually did win an award called the Hugo Award, but it's called The Probability Brooch, written by L. Neil Smith. And it probably sold, 40,000 copies or something like that. It didn't sell a huge, huge number. But what was unique and interesting about it was not only did it promote the idea of the many worlds theory, which you were talking about last week, Bill, but it also proposed what would happen if somebody from a society like ours ended up getting shifted through this many worlds theory to another universe where it was basically a libertarian society. What would he find when he got there? And it was a rather fascinating fictional discussion based on that premise. So we thought, why don't we take that basic idea and apply it here with our show? At least try it for a few minutes and see what happens. So
Walt is going to zoom off into the future of an alternate history of what likely will happen over the next, decade or two?
And it's a parallel. There's no shift in time. It's a shift in dimension, if you will. We're going to another hour in the same time frame, but because, or actually I am, you're going to stay here and somehow we're going to maintain a connection between the two of us through this probability approach, but essentially we're just going to compare what happened in that society through the same time frame to what happens in this society, or at least whatever extent we can within 10 minutes. I'm not sure how long we can do this, because from what I understand, these probability approaches are very expensive to run, so we can't do it for very long.
So you're going to jump through the blue dot?
Yeah, it starts. Oh, there. Hey, I can see it right now. There's a blue dot forming right in front of my eyes. It's starting to expand. Oh. Boom. Testing. Can you hear me? Hello? Anybody there?
Oh, there we go.
I hear you.
Hey, it worked.
You are now reporting from an alternate universe where history was totally different, and you're going to tell us all about what happened to money?
Well, among other things, yeah. I mean, I actually have a couple of the people who live in the society here, and they apparently were listening through that probability approach hole to our broadcast because they're curious about the USA and what life is like in our universe. It's sort of like a morbid curiosity. It's the kind of thing that, the equivalent in our country would be people going to a horror movie. So these are the people who like horror movies kind of listening in here. And in fact, one of them just handed me a piece of paper. What does it say? He was listening into our discussion about the gold standard, and his question is, why would anyone take worthless pieces of money in exchange for gold?
And so in your alternative universe, they didn't.
No, they don't do that. Well, actually, I had dinner with this group yesterday, and they actually use an electronic system similar to what we have, but they never actually engage in the fiat paper currency thing that we have here, or that we have where you are, actually, or where I normally am in the USA. So it's a new concept to them. On this paper that was handed to me, one of the questions they ask is, why don't we drag them into court and sue them for the fraud that they're creating? You want to try taking a stab at answering that one, Bill?
Well, I want to know what they actually did in the alternative universe. Did they take the bankers and hang them in the streets, or the people that did fractional reserves ended up in jails as robbers?
The philosophies of the American Revolution played out much more strongly here, I guess. One of the more interesting things, and I'm not quite sure why this works the way it does, but their version of Thomas Jefferson, they had a Thomas Jefferson like we did. Their version wrote a Declaration of Independence that had one extra word in it. And the extra word, it falls into the phrase consent of the governed. He threw in the word unanimous. He said you can't have a government without the unanimous consent of the governed. And that one word shifted, in a sense, the whole shooting match, so that while Jefferson was actually in Congress, he ended up, among other things, successfully banning the slave trade. And the interesting thing, by the way, in the USA, the same thing happened. Jefferson, I don't know if you're aware of this, Jefferson actually put a bill up in the old U.S. Congress under the Articles of Confederation to ban the slave trade, and it almost passed. We almost avoided the Civil War in the USA.
So in your alternate universe, was there ever a national bank? Wasn't this an argument between who, Madison and
Well, there wasn't an attempt to start a national bank until the Patriots of the era found out what they were trying to do, and that was about the same time of the Whiskey Rebellion. And the Whiskey Rebellion actually ended up going the other way. In the USA, the Whiskey Rebellion was suppressed. In this country, they call this the North American Confederacy. It's not really a government, but it's their equivalent of a government in this country, in this alternative universe. In the North American Confederacy, there was a Swiss financier named Albert Gallatin who essentially led the Whiskey Rebellion and led it to a rather peaceful resolution where, among other things, George Washington was shot dead, which is quite the opposite of what people in the USA would expect, because in the USA, of course, George Washington is a hero. But in the North American Confederacy, he's actually considered to be a traitor because he tried to sell out the revolution and put it back into the hands of the monarchists in a more federalized form.
Yeah.
I don't know a whole lot about the history, but that's how much I've learned, you know, from my limited stay here.
Oh, okay. So in your alternate universe, do you have a constitution or not?
The Constitution is a banned document. it literally never actually grabbed hold, because the attitude here about freedom was quite a bit stronger than it was in the USA, and the tolerance for government was greatly reduced compared to the USA. And the people here tell me they think it's because Jefferson put that extra word in the Declaration. I'm not so sure, but at least I can understand the argument.
So does the Confederacy have freedom of speech? They have monopolies? They have...
Actually, there's one really startling thing. The very first thing that you notice, and it's a little bit unnerving, especially for those of us who live in the USA, but for those of us who come over here through the brooch to the North American Confederacy, one of the first things we see is everybody's armed to the teeth. I mean, literally, everybody walks around with the biggest guns, and I don't know what some of them are. One they told me is a plasma gun. I don't even know what that is. But, I mean, everybody is armed to the teeth. And if that isn't the most surprising thing, then perhaps the most surprising thing is there doesn't seem to be any violence. There's no violence in the streets. Heck, you can hardly even find a newscast, which is really a nice change when you think about it. I'm surprised, to be honest. I'm surprised that you have this many weapons around, and people aren't killing each other left and right, but they aren't.
So in this alternate universe, was there a Hitler and a Stalin? Did these people with the guns go off to Europe and defeat the Nazis?
No, they never even arose. They never even came about. There's no mention of them at all.
Oh, so you just don't have any Hitlers or Stalins?
They just don't exist. I mean, the prevalent theory among the people around here, they don't call themselves political scientists, but they'd be kind of the equivalent. They're more like armchair political theorists who like to, engage in thinking that most of society frowns on. But the amateur political theorists around here seem to think that because freedom took on such a strong role so early, a lot of the things that we ended up experiencing in our in the USA never got a chance to take foot here because the resistance level was so high. So that's the general overall theory behind why these things have happened, or have never happened, actually. But now that they know, because of the probability brooch, that these other universes exist, and by the way, it's not just R2, there are a lot of these universes, they've been checking to find out, why is it that all these other universes have all these horrible figures that arise and they don't? And they've checked their own history as much as they can, and for the most part, they can't find any reference to these people. They don't even exist. Very strange.
Yeah, so you're saying in this alternate universe that freedom was popular not just in the United States, but became popular worldwide, and as a consequence, these tyrants didn't happen?
Well, the violence did happen, but because it's kind of similar to what happens with the USA in the world where you and I come from. The USA, because of its major role in the world, tends to have tremendous influence throughout the world, even in those countries that don't like the U.S. at all and have good reason not to like the U.S. I mean, Islamic countries, many of which have, very, I wouldn't say hate-based, but very distrustful relations with the United States. And yet you'll find in many of these countries blue jeans and, hip-hop records and all kinds of American influences, many of which are often banned by the government, but nevertheless, they're still there. So the U.S. has tremendous influence.
And wait a second. In your alternate universe, there's no government, but there is hip-hop? What else is different than the alternate universe?
I haven't learned about all the cultural side of it, so I don't know what all the music is that they've got here. What I do know is that the influence that the North American Confederacy has had on the world has been similar in nature. Not that they have the same kind of influence, not like they have hip-hop, but because of the role that the NAC has played in world history, they have had the same kind of influence in their universe as the USA has in the universe you and I come from. It just plays out differently because in their universe, the freedom is a much stronger concept and is a much more almost anarchic concept, so that when other countries try to copy it, instead of trying to set up democracy, they basically just try to tear down governments and replace them with this loose anarchy that the North American Confederacy has.
In your alternate universe, are there any banks?
There are banks, but not of the kind that you and I are used to. It's very common, for instance, for somebody who runs like a bar and grill to have a bank on the side. And you end up paying them to store the money in a safe or some safety solution that they have. But they don't have the same kind of banking system that you and I know where you have the fractionalization and the transactions only happening between banks on a major scale. They don't have that kind of thing.
So you got credit cards?
Their monetary system is much more decentralized than that.
You got credit cards and mortgages?
Actually, you don't tend to have mortgages very long. It's very common for somebody here to buy a house and pay it off within a couple of years because they don't have all of the stuff that makes housing expensive. So it's a different situation. I mean, you buy a car, you can basically buy a car with 3 months' wages,
These are what people are living in, log cabins and driving around horses. No,
these are houses we've got. The poorest people here have houses that make our wealthy developments in the USA look poverty-stricken by comparison.
Wow. So how did the computer come into existence in your alternate universe? Who borrowed the money?
The North American Confederacy, I'm not sure about who borrowed money. They actually, for them, currency isn't all that important, to be honest. For them, the currency that's more important is innovation. So they actually don't measure their history so much by politicians and kings and governments and currencies and banks and all that. They measure it by who invented what and when they invented it and what positive role did it have on society. So you have to really dig deep if you want to find out who financed stuff, although typically it was either self-financed or, friends got together and put money together, that kind of thing. It's not something where banks came in and financed everything. But the innovations came fast and furious long before they did in the United States. Color TV was firmly entrenched in 1929, or the equivalent of 1929. They use a different date counting system, but it's the equivalent. Almost anything that you can think of, computers came far earlier than they did here in the U.S. Their telecom, as they call it, is so far ahead of the Internet that we know that it makes the Internet look like a toy by comparison.
And, of course, they have universal health care.
No, not even close. What they actually have is they don't even have what they call health care. They have what they call healers. They don't have doctors. They don't have hospitals. They have healers. And these professional healers are very affordable. They're usually people who just operate on their own. It's not like you have a regulatory structure to keep them in line, and you don't have to get a special approval from some government somewhere to become a doctor. And yet the standards are actually, I would say, considerably higher than what we have here in the U.S. So it's a bit of a shock. It's a shock when you deal with almost everything here because it's so topsy-turvy upside down. I mean, one of the things that really knocks you down is how inexpensive everything is. Stuff is so freaking cheap, it's unbelievable. I mean, you go out and have a meal, and the cost of a meal is the equivalent of, 10 minutes of wage. It's ridiculous.
Oh, so everything is cheaper there?
Yeah, tremendously cheap. Yeah, by our standards. Yeah, yeah. And that's why they don't really have any poverty.
Ah.
Very interesting stuff, yeah. Unfortunately, from what I'm seeing here, it looks like the time we have allocated in the old USA is running out, so I better come back to the probability brooch and finish up the show with you.
Jump in that blue dot again.
Here it comes again.
Does that give you a headache or an upset stomach or something?
No, but you got to try that. That's like it's like being in two places at once. It's really weird.
Well, I think the only thing we missed was a little bit of echo, so we could distinguish your disorientation and removal from the normal course of events. But in any case,
that was a fun trip, though. I tell you.
the basic proposition being that with a smidgen more freedom in our early founding era, that we would be a heck of a lot better off.
Well, I don't think we can disagree with that part. We may disagree about whether it actually creates that society, but I think we actually need more than a smidgen more freedom. I think a whole lot more to it. But unfortunately, we have to leave it there because we're out of time. It's been a pleasure as usual, Bill.
Sure.
We'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds